From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, composer John Kander of the songwriting team Kander and Ebb. Their best-known musical is Cabaret. Their best-known song, New York, New York. Also, writer Raymond Andrews tells us about growing up the son of sharecroppers in rural Georgia. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new documentary on Marian Anderson that premieres on public television this week. And Owen Gleiberman reviews Tune In Tomorrow. It just came out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush's doctor said today that his irregular heartbeat was caused by a mildly overactive thyroid gland. The president's medical team said the condition is easily treatable with medication. The diagnosis was announced by doctors at Bethesda Naval Hospital, where the president spent 2 nights after suffering an irregular heartbeat while jogging. The president returned to work yesterday after his heartbeat was restored to normal by medication. Yugoslavia's leaders, the group known as the Federal Presidency, have adjourned an emergency meeting in Belgrade after 12 hours of heated debate. The group will meet again tomorrow to take up a defense ministry ultimatum for the disarming of illegal paramilitary groups, Pierre Vickery reports.
The Federal Presidency meeting adjourned just before midnight with no clear policies in response to the armed forces' ultimatum. The federal defense minister had demanded civilian approval for the military to move decisively to disarm all illegal paramilitary formations. Armed Serbian militias in the Republic of Croatia have been manning roadblocks in areas under their control and killed 12 Croatian policemen last week during a gunfight in the town of Bohovo Selo. The presidency authorized the Croatian government to take action to restore peace to the region and agreed that the armed forces would play a role. But the meeting stopped short of giving the military the clear mandate they were demanding. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Federal safety investigators today heard dramatic testimony from the surviving pilot of a U.S. Air jet that collided with a commuter plane on a runway at Los Angeles International Airport on February 4th. 34 people were killed. From Los Angeles, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The crash occurred when air traffic controller Robin Washer mistakenly directed the incoming U.S. Air jet and a commuter plane waiting to take off to the same runway at the same time. Today, during public National Transportation Safety Board hearings, co-pilot David Kennedy described what happened.
Just as I lowered the nose to the runway, it was a split second after the nose wheel had touched the ground that airplane all of a sudden showed up out of nowhere.
Documents released by the safety board reveal that prior to becoming a civilian controller, Robin Washer was discharged from her job as a military controller. She told senior officers she was incapable of controlling planes safely after the death of her parents in a plane crash. Documents released also reveal that although the controller received a satisfactory performance evaluation last December, she was unable to keep track of planes crossing the runway during the evaluation. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials lost 24 points today to close at 2,917.49. This is NPR News. The United Nations envoy to northern Iraq said today that Iraqi Kurds are leaving refugee camps on the borders and returning home faster than expected. Envoy Stefan de Mistura said that more than 4,000 refugees are being returned from their mountain camps each day. The number is expected to rise within the next few days as a full-scale military relocation program goes into operation. Legislation that would require a national 7-day waiting period for the purchase of handguns, known as the Brady Bill, suffered a setback in the House today. Although it goes to the floor for a vote tomorrow, a measure supported by the National Rifle Association will be acted on first. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The threat to the Brady bill actually comes from House members who say they favor both proposals. If the NRA-backed amendment is passed first, it would replace the Brady bill and prevent a vote on it. The amendment that the NRA supports would require an instant check system, which would screen gun buyers at the point of purchase. Brady bill supporter Charles Schumer of New York says it's a straw man designed to derail gun control.
Tomorrow, members of Congress are going to have to screw their courage to the sticking board. They're going to have to vote yes for Brady. And they're going to have to defeat the Staggers Amendment to vote yes on Brady.
The vote is considered by both sides to be too close to call. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Bush administration pressed Congress today to adopt its plans for a radical reform of the nation's banking laws. Timothy Ryan, the head of the Office of Thrift Supervision, told the Senate Banking Committee that it's not enough to simply refinance the Bank Deposit Insurance Fund. He said the banking laws need to be changed so that U.S. banks can engage in a broader range of businesses and compete more effectively in international markets. The administration is pushing for a Treasury proposal that would allow well-capitalized banks to expand into businesses like insurance. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The songs of Candor and Ebb are being celebrated off-Broadway in a new review called And the World Goes Round. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich raved about the show and described the Candor and Ebb aesthetic as splashy showbiz emotions emblemized by hyperbolic anthems of survival. That kind of anthem is best epitomized by one of their most popular songs, New York, New York. In their 25-year collaboration, John Candor and Fred Ebb have written the songs for the musicals Cabaret, Chicago, The Act, Woman of the Year, and Flora the Red Menace. Liza Minnelli is the singer most associated with their songs. In fact, she's singing some of them now in her new show at Radio City Music Hall, which was directed by Fred Ebb. Ebb writes the lyrics, Candor the music. Before we meet John Candor, let's listen to the song that the new Off-Broadway Review takes its title from. It was written for Liza Minnelli to sing in the movie New York, New York.
Sometimes you're happy and sometimes you're sad, but the world goes round. Sometimes you lose every nickel you've had, but the world goes round. Sometimes your dreams get broken pieces, but that doesn't alter a thing. Take it from me, there's still gonna be a summer, a winter, a fall and a spring. And sometimes a friend starts treating you bad, but the world goes round.
I know in talking to Stephen Sondheim that he said he didn't think he could write songs about the context of a show. That's why he doesn't write pop tunes, because the show gives you a sense of who the characters are, what kind of music is needed.
Right.
Do you feel that way, too? I mean, you've had, like, the first song that you wrote with Fred Ebb was My Coloring Book, and that was a pop hit on the radio and everything. But after that, I think virtually all the work you've done together has been for shows. Do you think you'd be writing songs if it wasn't for the context of Broadway shows?
No, I really don't. I think that when Fred and I first started working, for the first couple of years, we, in addition to being interested in the theater, we tried writing pop songs, and a few of them got performed, but for the most part, no. So I tend to agree with Stephen. We always write in some sort of context. If it's not for a show that we're writing, then it's for maybe it's a piece of special material for a couple of ladies that we're very fond of, Cheetah Rivera and Liza Minnelli.
Now, Fred Ebb couldn't be with us today because he's doing some last-minute work on a show. There's a run-through or something. Are you used to talking without him about your work?
No, I'm not.
Does it feel awkward?
Yeah. Fred is much more articulate than I. and usually we're in a room together. And questions get addressed to the two of us, and he will answer.
That makes it easy for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I like it that way, too.
What is your process of working together? Do you work together in the same room at the same time?
Right. Fred lives about four blocks from my house, and he likes to stay home to work. I like to go out to work. And at 10 o'clock or so in the morning, I'll go over to his house, and we will sit around the kitchen table and have some coffee and gossip a little and then go to work. And if we're working on a moment in a show, for instance, we'll be talking about the characters and the situation that we're about to musicalize. And Fred may have an idea or a phrase, and from that phrase, maybe we'll develop a rhythm. It's very hard to describe it after that except to say that we improvise together at the same time in the same room. It's a kind of unique way of working for us. Most people do not work that way. Either somebody hands somebody a melody or somebody hands somebody a lyric. That never happens to us, or almost never. And for the 26 or so years that we've been together, that's always been the way we worked. And it's always fun. I don't know how to say that without sounding goony, but it's true. Whatever else is going on in our lives, sitting together in a room and writing a song is always a good time, even when our work is bad.
Let me pick up on what you just said, even if the work is bad. Now, when do you decide that you don't like a song if you're going to tear it up? Do you know that right away, or is it like 3 days later that you realize, God, that was a bad song?
Sometimes you know it right away. Usually it takes about 24 hours. And then I'll come back the next day, we'll look at it, and we'll both stick our fingers down our throats and tear it up and go to work again. But that's never a terrible moment. I think it's very important, at least it always has been important for us, to stay very loose, which allows you to write badly as well as to write well. But we write a lot, and we tear up a lot.
In some ways, I think you're best known for your anthem songs like New York, New York, or even, And the World Goes Round, I think of as being a real anthem-like song. When you sit down to compose something that you know is going to be big and anthem-like, are you thinking about anything different than when you're sitting down to compose a ballad?
No, I think, at least speaking for myself, we just try to fill the moment. Each moment that you write for in the theater has its requirements, and you try to fulfill those requirements as honestly as you can, keeping the diction of the characters in mind and their real emotions. New York, New York is an example, though, of tearing up things and starting again. We wrote some songs for the movie New York, New York, and one of our assignments was to write a title song, and we brought it in and played it for Liza and Scorsese, and they liked it just fine. And Robert De Niro was there, who was starring in the movie, and I could see him over in the corner with Scorsese gesturing quite vehemently. And Scorsese came back and almost apologetically said that De Niro felt that the song was not a heavyweight enough song, and would we take another shot at it? Well, we were both highly insulted, of course, and we said yes, and we were being very stuffy about it. Anyway, we went home and wrote the second version of New York, New York, which is the song that became very popular. The point of that story is that if it were not for Robert De Niro, we would never have had a hit song called New York, New York.
Start spreading the news, I'm leaving today. I wanna be a part of it. New York, New York, these vagabond shoes are longing to stray and step around the heart of it. New York, New York.
my little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York.
Tricks to writing a big song like that, like key changes or movements up the octave or anything that you feel like you draw on when you're writing a big, triumphant kind of song?
I have absolutely no awareness of them. I'm sure there are, I'm sure there are plenty of cliches that I create for myself, but I don't know what they are. There are people who have said that there's a kind of Kander and Ebb style to a song, or they can recognize a Kander and Ebb song. Well, I couldn't. I have no idea what we do. I just know that at the end of writing a piece, I'm happy if I like it.
My guest is composer John Kander, half of the songwriting team Kander and Ebb. Their collaboration is being celebrated in a new off-Broadway review called And the World Goes Round. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Songwriter John Kander is my guest. Now, let's get back to New York, New York. That song was written for the movie of the same name.
Right.
And, it's a great song, but nothing much happened to it after the movie until Sinatra recorded it. How did he pick up on the song?
Damned if I know. Liza made this wonderful record of it, and I thought she sang it brilliantly in the movie and on the record. It didn't go anywhere. The song was not nominated for an Academy Award or anything like that. And that was the year that we were not nominated, and the entire score of Saturday Night Fever was also not nominated. But that's another story. Anyway, a few years later, and I don't know how he got the song, Sinatra got it, liked it, and recorded it, and performed it a lot. And I cannot tell you why his made it and Liza's didn't. That's one of those chemical things that is beyond me. At any rate, they both have done us proud, and we're very grateful for what happened to that song.
Now, you studied classical music. How did you end up writing for Broadway and writing pop?
Oh, gosh. I've always been sort of musically schizoid, I guess. I grew up loving classical music and loving the theater, too. When I was a little kid and was collecting records, I had a picture of Lotte Lehmann as the Marshal in Der Rosenkavalier on one end of my bureau, and a picture of Gertrude Lawrence in Lady in the Dark on the other end of my bureau. This is true. And I would see those two faces every morning. And I think deep down inside, I thought, if ever I run away from home, I'm going to run away to one of those two ladies, but I don't know which. And I didn't think that I was speaking to myself symbolically, but I guess I was. Then, when I was at Columbia getting my master's, the head of the music department was someone who became my very great friend and who became my family, he and his family, and that was the composer Douglas Moore, who was an opera composer. He wrote The Ballad of Baby Doe, among other wonderful things. And we spent a lot of time together, and one slightly drunken night, when we were playing music back and forth, and he said, you know, if I had it to do all over again, I think I'd write for Broadway. And in a funny way, that gave me a seal of approval on a decision I think I'd probably already made subconsciously and didn't know I had.
Now, you met your partner almost on a blind date, so to speak.
Sounds like it, yes.
Yeah, because you were basically set up by the music publisher, Tommy Volando, who had been publishing both of you independently, and what, he suggested that you get together? Do I have the story right?
He literally said, I think you two guys should meet each other. I think you'd like each other. And so since we always followed his advice separately at the time, we did meet each other, we did like each other, and we started writing almost immediately. I don't know, we were just pregnant with song all the time, it seemed to me. And from then on, we've been one of those marriages in which you're pretty faithful to each other. Fred has done some material with someone else, and I do an occasional movie score, as I am at the moment. But when it comes down to the hardcore of what we've written, we write together.
What kind of film score are you working on now?
It's for the movie based on Billy Bathgate that Robert Benton has directed with Dustin Hoffman and Bruce Willis.
That's great. So you're doing the score for that?
Yeah, it scares me to death.
Well, okay, you're doing the score for this, and you don't have someone to work off of, like you always work with Fred Ebb.
Well, when I'm doing a film score, I only do a film score if I know that I have a director who's going to be really generative and open with me. And I've done three movies with Robert Benton before, and he's extremely communicative and generative to me. So it's like having a collaborator.
Mm-hmm. You and Fred Ebb started writing for Broadway at a time when rock music was really displacing Broadway music as the pop music of the day. And even on Broadway, a few years after you started working, you know, shows of, like, I think of as ersatz rock music started taking over, shows like Hair. Do you feel that your kind of songwriting has been displaced at certain periods by rock music?
Well, yes, in one sense. When I was growing up, and even into the early days of my career, a great deal of what was popular music came from the theater. A hefty percentage of the song hits that swept the country came out of Broadway theater. Then, when rock music took over commercially, songs were no longer extracted from Broadway musicals. The perfect example I can give you is that when I walked into my hotel room in Boston before the first performance of Cabaret, I turned on the radio while I was unpacking, and there were five songs on the radio from our show. There had already been that many records made. And at the first performance, the song Cabaret was already a hit. That was the last time anything like that happened. So I guess there is pop music and there's classical music, and then somewhere in some other category there is what we would have to call theater music.
Are there really significant ways that you think Broadway or the theater has changed since you started writing?
Sure. Fred and I and Jerry Herman and Steve Sondheim and our generation were the last generation to be able to get their work done and fail and then be able to get produced again. The theater was not nearly as expensive. There were a lot of very active, very imaginative producers around. That's changed, and I can think of a number of factors. The change in the music business, of course. The skyrocketing expenses of putting on a Broadway musical compared to 25 years ago. The fact that there is only one newspaper in New York now that matters critically. Now, whoever is working at the New York Times has the power to make or break a Broadway show, so that producers are terrified to do anything that they don't feel has a good chance of getting the approval of the New York Times.
You say that you think you're in the last generation that was allowed to fail and then to keep working. What did you have that failed?
Oh, for a show we wrote, Flora of the Red Menace, was a failure. I had a show before that, before I met Fred, which was a show that Hal Prince directed. It was the first show that he directed, too. It was called A Family Affair. And that ran for just a few months. Flora ran for just a few months. But the week before Flora opened on Broadway, Hal Prince, who was the producer of it, said, no matter what happens when Flora opens, the day after that, let's get together at my house and we will talk about the next show. And the next show was Cabaret. And we did get together at his house at 4 o'clock the afternoon of the day after the opening. That's very luxurious. It wasn't unheard of at the time, but it was it's something which would never happen today.
Why not?
It's too expensive. To get enough people together to raise the amount of money that it takes to create a Broadway musical is so difficult that there is nobody that you would call a producer. When Hal was producer or David Merrick was producing, they had their backers and they simply called up the money that they needed for a production so they could open the show this week, and whatever the reviews said, they knew that if they had another product, they could raise the money for it. Now that's very, very difficult.
When you're writing a song, do you dream the song until it's finished?
What do you mean by that?
Well, that you go to sleep and the song keeps playing and playing as you're trying get to sleep.
Oh, yes. That's awful. And as a matter of fact, that goes on all during rehearsal. When I go out of town with a show or even when I'm in town rehearsing, I have a tape recorder next to my bed with a lot of chamber music on it, a lot of Brahms and a lot of Mozart, a lot of Schubert, something to erase my own music from my head so that I can go to sleep. I can remember when I was conducting musicals in stock in the 50s, whatever show I was rehearsing would go on in my head all night long, and I could not go to sleep until I'd gotten through the whole score in my head, and it was murder. I remember when I was conducting South Pacific, and I finally got a technique. I would start from the beginning of the show, but I would race the tempo, and the overture went very fast. I remember Happy Talk went so fast that I almost laughed when I got to it. Finally, I'd get to the end, and then I could go to sleep.
Does it sometimes make you like hate the songs that you like that you're writing because you can't knock it out of your mind?
No, because something else happens, to me anyway. Once the song is written and orchestrated and performed and the show has opened, it's gone. By gone, I mean a year after a show has opened, I can practically not play a single thing from it from beginning to end without the music in front of me. And I've been playing the piano all my life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Freddie agrees, feels this the same way that I do. I think he does. Once you finish something and somebody has sung it, it's gone. It's not yours anymore. And consequently, when you go back and listen to it, you can either like it or not like it, just as if it were somebody else's music.
So that's nice. That means you're probably not the kind of composer who feels that a singer has to perform a song exactly the way you wrote it.
No, that in the theater, you get the performance that you want for that moment, and particularly if you've written the song to fulfill a particular moment, you know how you want it to sound. After that, it's fair game.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, too. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Songwriter John Kander. A new review of Kander and Ebb songs is off-Broadway at the West Side Theater in Manhattan. Liza Minnelli is singing Kander and Ebb songs in her new show at Radio City Music Hall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When writer Raymond Andrews was a kid in rural Georgia, His family had 10 children, 30 acres, 2 mules, and a perpetual debt to the landowner. Coming up, Andrews tells us about life as a sharecropper in the last generation of sharecroppers. Also this week, PBS premieres a documentary on Marian Anderson. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Tune In Tomorrow. It just came out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The president of the Soviet Republic of Armenia claims that at least 60 people have been killed in clashes between troops of Azerbaijan and armed civilians in Armenia. The Armenian leader has accused Soviet leader Gorbachev of waging an undeclared war against his republic. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Moscow.
Armenian President Ter Petrosyan said Soviet Army and Interior Ministry troops supported by Azerbaijani police have now surrounded and occupied three more villages inside Armenia. They are reportedly demanding villagers hand over their weapons. Earlier fighting had been concentrated around Armenian villages near Nagorno-Karabakh, an Armenian enclave inside the Republic of Azerbaijan, which is claimed by both republics. Soviet President Gorbachev has said illegal Armenian nationalist groups based in the region must be disarmed and disbanded before there can be a political solution to the ethnic feuding between the two republics. But Ter Petrosyan said today Gorbachev has deliberately fueled the conflict to terrorize the Armenian people and overthrow the Armenian government, which is demanding independence from Moscow. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
Doctors for President Bush say that his recent experience with an irregular heartbeat was caused by an overactive thyroid gland. The president's medical team says this conclusion comes on test that took several days to analyze and reconfirm. Doctors say this condition is easily treatable with medication. After years of delay, the Environmental Protection Agency has announced a new rule to limit the amount of dissolved lead in drinking water. Lead has been linked to health problems, especially in children. NPR's Michael Skolder reports.
As many as 1 in 6 children may suffer from lead exposure, which can impair a child's physical and mental development. Most government actions so far have focused on reducing lead in paint, in air, and in soil. But lead can also get into drinking water from old plumbing pipes and soldered joints. EPA's new rule requires water suppliers to add chemicals to water that will help block lead from leaching into the water. If that doesn't work, companies will have to replace old lead-containing pipes, but they will have up to 23 years to complete the lead reduction work. Critics say that is far too long and argue the EPA has shirked its legal duty to set a lead standard and then enforce it quickly. Congressional hearings on the new rule are set for later this week. This is Michael Skolder in Washington.
In Beirut, strikes by school teachers and bank workers have continued in protest over rising inflation and government failure to solve economic problems. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 24 points to close at 2,917.49. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, a House subcommittee has voted to cut all space weapons research out of the so-called Star Wars program. Another House panel also voted to stop production of the B-2 stealth bomber with the 15 already started. One House committee reportedly voted to cut the president's $5.2 billion Star Wars request to $3.5 billion. Today in Cleveland, moderate and conservative Democrats wrapped up the first national convention of the Democratic Leadership Council. Before heading home, delegates approved what they call a mainstream platform they hope will help the Democrats regain the White House in 1992. Joe Smith of member station WCPN in Cleveland reports.
DLC leaders have made no secret of the fact that their group is trying to break from the New Deal roots of the party, and this has angered the more liberal faction of the party. Today, Democratic Chairman Ron Brown called for an end to the fighting.
Healthy, good faith debate over policies and approaches are at the very core of our party and at the very core of our nation. But factions and bickering serve no purpose except to strengthen our opposition.
Despite Brown's pleas, DLC delegates approved several policy positions that are to the right of the Democratic Party platform. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Smith in Cleveland.
Secretary of State James Baker plans to make Syria the first stop on his upcoming trip to the Middle East. The State Department says that Baker will meet with Syrian President Assad this weekend before leaving for Cairo. Earlier, U.S. officials had said that Baker will also visit Israel and Jordan during his trip, his fourth since the end of the Persian Gulf War. In trading in Europe, the dollar moved lower. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A new documentary about the life of singer Marian Anderson airs this week on PBS, on Wednesday night in most cities. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review. The great singer is now 89 and was interviewed for the film. Here's an excerpt from it.
I don't know that I had to decide. It was something that just had to be done. I don't think I had much to say in choosing it. I think music chose me.
This moving documentary traces the life of Marian Anderson from her birth in Philadelphia in 1902 to her international celebrity, both as an artist and as a role model and door opener for other black performers. She started as a child prodigy, singing at the Union Baptist Church. She was 10 when her father died, and her mother, a former teacher, supported Marian and her sisters by scrubbing floors at Wanamaker's department store. Anderson remembers that her mother paid her first voice teacher $1 a lesson. In the 1920s and 30s, Europe was far more open to black artists than America was. Anderson's career really was launched in Paris and Scandinavia. She was a great personal favorite of Jean Sibelius, one of the few facts this documentary forgets to mention. Her luckiest break was probably Toscanini's famous remark that hers was a voice heard only once in 100 years. The film is quite eloquent about the plight of black performers in this country. Some theaters simply refused black artists. Others wouldn't allow blacks to sit in the audience. Anderson would not perform unless blacks were given equal seating, though that seating was usually separate as well as equal. Narrator Avery Brooks makes a useful distinction between Anderson, who by her own admission was not a fighter, and her friend Paul Robeson, who was. He became the victim of anti-communist paranoia for his outspokenness. The most moving sequence in the documentary concerns Anderson's most famous concert. In 1936, she sang at the White House, but she was not allowed to perform in Constitution Hall, which was owned and operated by the Daughters of the American Revolution. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt resigned from the DAR in outrage, and the concert was held instead on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Here's how it began. That's Todd Duncan reminiscing. He was the original Porgy in Porgy and Bess.
The highlight were the first words that she sang. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing.
Everyone interviewed talks about Anderson's royal dignity, how she's like a queen or the Statue of Liberty. But my favorite moment on the program, aside from Anderson's singing, is the irrepressible, all-encompassing tomboy grin that spreads across her face at the end of America. Other highlights include Anderson's belated Metropolitan Opera debut in 1955, when she became the first black artist to sing a leading role there. And there's a brief clip of her making a speech when she was Eisenhower's delegate to the UN. Of course, the great things in this film are the precious clips of Anderson at the height of her powers.
He bowed his head on dark, and he never said a mumbling word. He bowed his head on dark.
Unfortunately, as in many musical documentaries, the music is given short shrift. Anderson's performances keep getting interrupted by people talking, while her singing continues under their voices as if she had been asked to leave the room. No one should forget that her voice is the reason for this documentary to begin with.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. The Marian Anderson documentary airs on most PBS stations Wednesday night. This is Fresh Air. Raymond Andrews' family was among the last of the sharecroppers. There were sharecroppers in rural Georgia from 1943 to the end of the decade. Andrews was 15 in 1949 when he left the farm for Atlanta. He's written three novels about black rural and small-town life in Georgia. His new book is a memoir about his childhood called The Last Radio Baby. It's illustrated by his brother, the artist Benny Andrews. Raymond Andrews told me about the arrangement between the landowner and his parents when they became sharecroppers.
Well, the sharecropping deal was whereby whatever you raise, he would get half of it.
The landowner?
The landowner. No matter what it was, he would get half. For instance, you had 20 bales of cotton, 10 bales would go to him. He got everything from that. And your 10 bales, you had to pay him for the seed and fertilizer from that part. And at the end of the year, you sold them that you had anything left over.
And your parents had what, 20 acres and a mule?
Well, we had 20 acres and a mule, then we got 30 acres and two mules.
You say your parents made a profit only once in the 7 years that they were sharecroppers. Did you have enough money for the family to live on?
Yes, but at that time you didn't need money like you would today. The main thing was food, and we raised most of that. And you would buy clothing at the end of the year, your winter clothing, because during the summer most of the kids went around wearing practically nothing. This is in the South, too. So you went bare feet in the summer. And just during the winter, you need the clothing. Warm clothing, that is. And if you didn't make any money from the farm, you could always borrow the money from the landowner, which would, of course, go in on the debt for your next year's crop. So you were constantly in debt. That's what it amounted to.
As a child, how much were you expected to work?
All the time. On the farm, you're expected to work as long as that was work, which on the farm, that was work every day.
So what kind of work did you do?
Well, we did farm work, and during the time, there was nothing in the field. You did things around the house, like mending fences and building sheds and things of that nature. And also, the landowner had other businesses, like he had the planter mill, fertilizer plant, peach orchards, and things like that. So you worked in those. But my mother insisted upon us going to school. So during the winter, we went to school, which most children in the community didn't do. My mother's a bit different in that respect.
Well, I'm sure a lot of the parents thought it was better to have the children working to keep the farm going.
Right, and also to bring in money. So we had to do without that a lot of times just to go to school.
What gave your mother that faith in education?
Well, she came from a family that was educated, for the area. She had come from another part of the county. And her father had believed strongly in education.
Did she disagree with your father?
Oh, yeah, they disagreed completely over education at the time.
My father wanted
it, but he didn't want to stand up for it. My mother stood up. At that time, it was easier for a black woman to stand up for what she believed in than it was for a black man.
Why?
Well, it became whereby black male versus the white male, who was going to win. But the black woman could say straight things with just a woman talking.
You describe your father as a closet reader. He used to love to read, but he wouldn't want anybody to know it.
My father was also a painter, and he also played the guitar and the violin, which is called the fiddler. He did all of these things as a child. He was taught these things. But you didn't do those things. Real men didn't do those things. They went out and they worked and they fought and they drank and had too many children, got too deeply in debt. And you didn't do stuff like women did reading, girls. But real men didn't do that. So he would sneak and read.
How did you end up leaving your parents' farm when you were 15 years old?
At that time, when the cotton picking machine came in the late 40s, the sharecropping farms were breaking up. And my oldest brother, Harvey, lived in Atlanta, so he thought it'd be a good idea if I came to Atlanta, worked, and went to school at night. And so the families thought it was the best thing, too, because to get an inside job at that time was considered a good thing. Inside meant not working out in the fields or the woods. So I went to Atlanta with the idea of working and going to school, finishing school there.
Where did you stay?
I stayed at the YMCA, which is at that time, most country boys, country children, that is, went to Atlanta, would stay at either the YMCA or the YWCA. And it was full of country people.
What surprised you most about the city?
Atlanta?
Yeah.
When I got here, the biggest thing that bothered me later was the buses. Because we didn't have public transportation where I lived in Madison. I got to Atlanta, and I'd heard about it before, and I was exposed for the first time to so directly the racial situation, because you couldn't sit in front on the bus. You had to sit either in the back. And when I first got here, I was so awed by the city, I would get on the bus and sit anywhere. Being a light-skinned person, people weren't quite sure as to who I was. Until one day a woman found out and she sent me to the back. So after that, I stopped riding buses. I would walk every place I would go.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did you start riding?
How? Well, I always wanted to write from the time I can remember. Early, I drew pictures. And I wanted to write, but I thought when you wrote a book and sent it in, you had to have every period and paragraph in place. And if you didn't, they would be rejected by the publisher. So I'd never heard of editors. So I didn't write anything until I was 32. That's when I started writing.
When you left home, your parents were still sharecroppers. How long did they stay on the farm?
Well, no, what happened, the last year I was there was the last year of sharecropping, because the next year, my father started what they call working by the day. We moved from the sharecropping area because this Mr. Mason, he had gotten cotton picking machines to come in there, and so he had no longer had any use for sharecroppers. See, the idea was one of the ideas of my going to Atlanta was to help save money to send back and bring the family up. So the four oldest children worked and saved money, and later on we sent money to my parents to move to Atlanta. And so in 1953 they moved. Except my father, he didn't want to leave. But my mother brought the six youngest children to Atlanta, and so they lived there for the rest of the time.
Did your parents separate over this?
Yeah, they eventually divorced over that. Yes. My father wanted to remain in Madison. He didn't want to go to Atlanta. Mm-hmm. He's still there, too. My mother's in Atlanta, yeah. They're divorced now, yes.
Where do you live now?
Well, right now I live in Athens, Georgia. I actually live between Athens, Georgia, and New York City. My brother is the painter, Benny. He has a place in New York, so we switch over. He has galleries in Georgia. I mean, in the South. So he comes South during the summer and work in this area. And I go North and I spend 2 or 3 months there in New York.
That sounds like a nice arrangement.
It is. I like it. I need to get away for a while, and he needs to get away. So it works well for the both of us.
In your inscription for your memoir, you quote your brother Benny, who said to you, "You and I were too naive to know we couldn't make it."
Oh, yeah. We were a bit naive when I look back at things. We just figured that we got out and we just do what we wanted to do and keep working at it, and we would do it. Now, I got to New York, and I found out later that I had never met so many pessimistic people about chances of doing things. And we figured that once we got a chance to do it, no matter what it was, we would do it. And so it's hard to explain. I just had never met so many people before who was what I call downers, pessimistic about doing things. And we weren't, when I look back at it. We just figured, given a chance, we would do it.
Was there more than naivete involved? Did your parents also give you that sense that you could do what you wanted to do?
Oh, yes, yes. We got that, especially from my mother. She said we could do anything we wanted to do, as long as we prayed, as long as you prayed and you went to school. There's two things we did with her. We went to school and to church. Those two things we did. So she, as long as you go to school and pray, you do anything. You can be anything you want to.
Did prayer help?
Well, I think, yes, it helped. It helped, yeah. It helped. But I think also working hard helped, too.
Raymond Andrews' memoir is called The Last Radio Baby. It's published by Peachtree in Atlanta. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have news today of what's happening with Kurdish refugees in the north of Iraq. And also, we'll talk with a Kurdish spokesman in London about what Kurdish leaders are saying to the Iraqi government in Baghdad as they try to negotiate an autonomy agreement. It doesn't seem as though they have agreed to very much at this point. Also, we'll have the second and concluding part of John Burnett's series on fraud in the insurance industry. Many of the practices that people have uncovered in failing insurance companies are reminiscent of some of the problems detected in SNLs that went down some years ago.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The movie Tune In Tomorrow has just come out on home video. It's an adaptation of Mario Vargas Llosa's novel Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter. Critic Owen Gleiberman says the reason for renting this one is definitely the scriptwriter.
Comedies are rarely in short supply. But a movie with a genuine comic vision, one that reshapes the way we see our lives, comes along once every couple of years, if we're lucky. Tune In Tomorrow is a sublimely funny and romantic movie, one that draws you away, ever so gently, from reality. It's set in New Orleans in 1951 and has three main characters. Keanu Reeves plays Martin, a 21-year-old college kid who works at the local radio station. Barbara Hershey is Julia, his scandalous 36-year-old aunt by marriage. She's just returned to town after 20 years, and Martin is nuts about her. Peter Falk is Pedro Carmichael, an infamous creator of radio serials who's hired by the station to boost its sagging ratings. The soap opera Pedro cooks up is a hilariously tasteless schlock melodrama from hell. It centers on a brother and sister who are passionately in love. Falk does a terrific turn as the mischievous, foul-mouthed Pedro, who hates Albanians and lives for his trashy art.
I want your souls to enter those microphones and emerge like ghosts in the homes of our listeners. There's an army of them out there, groping blindly, toiling in the darkness, waiting for what? For you! For your incandescent, brilliant, palpitating talent to light up their miserable, impoverished, dull, and worthless lives!
Before long, Pedro starts to manipulate Martin and Julia's relationship so they'll provide fodder for his soap opera. He pulls them apart and pushes them back together. The movie cuts back and forth between their roller coaster romance and the soap opera it both mirrors and feeds. Here's one of their typical boy meets girl squabbles.
Julia.
Yeah?
These last weeks, well, I want you to know that. Well, that I think that I'm beginning to fall in love.
Hold it.
What?
A bad attack of mood is what? Just send home the violinist, will you? Just turn up the lights.
God, you're obnoxious. I don't know why I even bother. Jesus.
Ugh. Why do you guys do this?
Do what?
Why do you always think you have to be filthy to be sincere?
I'm sincere. I'm not filthy.
You're sincere and you're poor. It's the same difference.
Listen, if you're happy, it doesn't matter how poor you are.
Oh, you fell for that one too, huh?
A scene or two later, Martin is overhearing his own words on the radio. With its comic merging of reality and illusion, Tune In Tomorrow sometimes recalls Woody Allen's The Purple Rose of Cairo. That movie said life is drab and pop culture makes it bearable. Tune In Tomorrow captures something subtler and more magical. It's about how even the most vulgar pop fantasies enable us to experience our lives as drama. Hershey and Reeves have a playful chemistry. And Falk steals every scene he's in as the outlandish Pedro, who rhapsodizes about his soap opera as if it were Shakespeare. The fun of the movie is that it's in agreement with Pedro. Tune In Tomorrow is an impish act of cinematic gamesmanship. It's occasionally a little precious, but it casts a spell.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tui. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross, and here's some of Wynton Marsalis' music from Tune In Tomorrow.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the Lion of Zimbabwe, singer Thomas Mafumo. His music helped fuel the struggle for majority rule in his country. Also, humorist Cynthia Heimel on the frustrations of dating in the 90s at the age of 40. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.